You're listening to WWBC Coco, Melbourne, Titusville, 1510 AM, as well as W234BI, Coco, Rockledge, and W264AS, Rockledge, Melbourne, Palm Bay, and 100.7 FM.
Treasure Coast. This is Sita McGee on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends, heard right here in sunny Cocoa, Florida on AM 1510 WWBC, FM 94.7, 99.9, 100.7, and Ellen, everywhere else.
All over the World Wide Web. That's right. Here on 1510WWBC.com, you can hit that Listen Live button and get us on any one of your streaming devices that you have available to you, or you can see it's radio. You can hear all of our archive shows.
We do look great for being on radio too.
We really do. I think it's not bad. Of course, we share all of our archive shows on our Facebook page as well as our website, which houses all of the pictures and videos and blogs from all of our shows, and that's sitamediainc.com. 14 years of shows, 2 guests a show. 14 years, that's a lot of people. And you can search by name, by the way, as well. So if you have a favorite person that's been on as a guest, you can search by name on any one of our Facebook pages or the show page and get that information right away. Great interviews we've had. And today is no different.
That's right. So Ellen O'Neill is my right hand. And for so long, I had 3 names, and it's kind of hard to just say.
I know.
Like me, Sita Durjan Ishmael Begi. Then you cut off half of it and just keep Begi because it's too much. So Ellen O'Neill, myself, and Ali Tambor, we sit here. Ellen is my co-host, and she also takes care of our website and invoices and helping me to book the guests. I couldn't have the show without you, Elle, so thank you. And Ali is our resident guest intern forever. She's just going to be here guesting with us. So today,
I have questions.
That's right. So today is no different. So we sit here on Mondays and we speak with people from all over the United States, right here in Brevard County, Florida, and worldwide. And we speak about things. Sometimes we actually speak about spiritual issues. We speak about financial stuff. We speak about books. We speak about opening a business, getting into college. Sometimes we talk about the foundation for the family. Whatever it is, we speak. And our show has become a place for authors. A lot of authors come on our show because everybody has a story to tell.
Well, and that's how we met, were writing your book. You were writing your book, 18 Brothers and Sisters, and I was in the middle of writing my business books at that time. Remember? And we were kind of doing that whole little book tour together. So
right, and we met.
Authors are like near and dear to our hearts.
And we had a mutual friend at ABWA.
Also an author, right? Michael
that's
Everett.
Right. Very handsome.
I was on a book tour, actually, with him when I met you.
Here, here. Wow. So today's no different, right? And we all know that freedom of speech comes with a responsibility. And being here on WWBC, we tend to take that very seriously. And we have great conversations with people. We try to tell folks that, you know, it's just about being respectful, being fair-minded, and having an open ear to listen. So today's no different. I have 2 segments today. Our first segment is going to be with an author, which I booked, and I'm so happy that I met him. His name is Casey Coors. He's a retired high school teacher, and we are going to be discussing his new book, Chasing the Queen's Gambit, in addition to other books like Another Celebration of Words. And our second segment will be with one of the co-founders, this is actually nationwide, Moms for Liberty, Tina Deskovich. I can never say your middle name. So don't worry about that. We're good. So how do you say your middle name?
Oh, that's my maiden name. That's Schwazik. But
it's a good thing I didn't try.
Yeah. Tina Deskovich is my proper name.
And that's so easy to say. So we'll speak with Tina on the second segment. We'll talk a little bit about what they're doing with Moms for Liberty. And we'll have a conversation. Sometimes it's nice to have a conversation, collaborate, and communicate. Mm-hmm. And we learn from each other, right? Like we always say, we learn on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends on our fun, unscripted, educational show We learn from each other. We learn from history. We learn from life experience. And Lord knows you guys got a little bit from me. We learn from books and we learn from whatever it is, the people that came before us. And we can have a conversation. But before we go to Tina, we're going to talk with Mr. Casey Coors. Casey, thank you for taking the drive up from all the way Orlando and coming to our show. Yeah, get your mics close to you. And here we go. Thank you, Miss Ellen. That's live radio for you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Casey.
My pleasure.
And, you know, we have something in common, too, because my grandmother's name was Casey. But she spelt it with, yeah, she spelt it just like you. See,
wow, that's...
And for an Indian lady, that was pretty wild to have a name. Yeah. Casey. That was my nanny Raj, my nanny's name, Casey. So tell us a little bit about yourself. I know you're a retired high school teacher, and I know you love to write books. And, boy, you've got quite an extensive history with the stuff you're doing.
Thank you. Yes, I do. First of all, thank you, Sita, for having me on your show, and thank you for doing this show. I think community radio is one of the... Community radio and libraries are the backbone of a civilized society, I think. And so I love... Dr. King said one of the challenges we have is we have too many monologues and not enough dialogues. And I think that something like this, which gets us thinking and talking, is a real positive thing for the world. So thank you for doing this.
Yeah, so you in addition to being an author and a high school teacher, English literature, you said, right? You also hosted your own show.
I did. It's called the Casey Coar Show. It's still up and running on the internet. I've been doing it for 20 years. And so that has been a labor of love. I slowed down on the interviews when I started teaching. I taught a class called AP English Language and Composition for the past 15 years. So I did a lot of grading of essays and a lot of SAT prep and ACT prep with critical reading passages. And whenever I had students write, I had 100 AP students, I would edit pretty much about 20 to 25 hours a week. So I edited a book about every week.
Wow.
But I love it. So to me, it wasn't really work, but it was hard for me to write myself on top of doing that. So.
Yeah. So how did you get into actual writing your books? Because something must have happened. In addition to editing all the books, quote unquote, and it's for the children, you said, look, you're retired now and you're writing your books.
Right. I've had an unnatural attraction to books since I was a child. My mother had to take my allowance money away because I bought comic books.
Yeah.
This was 60 years ago. So I've always been fascinated with books. And when my mom got me a library card, I walked in, I loved the smell, and I told the librarian, I'm going to read every book in this library. And when I finished a book, I would run it down to the library and give it back. I still do that today because I figure somebody else wants to read it. So I started writing books about 40 years ago. Because I believe that anyone who's an avid reader, and I'm a compulsive reader, eventually you want to try your own hand at writing something. And so I started that about 40 years ago of writing, and I continue to do it now. Right now, I write 3 hours a day, even though I'm retired. I write 3 hours a day, day in and day out. I take Sundays off, but I love to write. I love to read, but I prefer to write.
Is it like a muscle you have to use it a lot so that you are swift and deft with it?
Yes, and I think that momentum for me as a writer is critical. So once I get momentum going, I want to keep going. And I find that physically and mentally, 3 one-hour blocks a day is about as much as my body and my mind can take. But I'm extremely disciplined in that practice.
Do you write like in a study on a desk, or do you have like a happy place? Because I know I once wrote something on a napkin, and I said, when I go home, I'm going to write this in a safe spot. And then I blew my nose, and there goes the tissue.
It's a good question. And I have a Guatemala T-shirt on, and actually the last 10 years I've written 3 books in Antigua, Guatemala, which is a little village in Guatemala, where I go when I was on break from teaching. I would go there for a week.
Why Guatemala of all places?
It was my happy place. I found a hotel there where they actually kept my clothes there, and I stayed in the same hotel room. It's inexpensive but a beautiful hotel, and when I go there, I unplug technology, and I would write for 5 to 6 hours a day when I was in Guatemala. So the last 3 books I wrote in Guatemala. But now that I'm retired, I put on my Guatemala T-shirt, and I live in Orlando, Florida, so I do those hour-block shifts in Orlando. It's easier than flying to Guatemala. But I had to do that to get away from my responsibilities of teaching.
So what was the first book you had published, and how did it feel?
The first book, I remember the first magazine article I had published was in 1995, and it felt like I won the lottery or something like that. It was a magazine called Billiards Digest. It was about Walter Tevis, but it was 35 years ago or 30 years ago. And I remember I drove around to every magazine store in Columbus and bought every copy they had. I left one at each store because I wanted to send one to my mom, my grandma, my sister, and that. I look back now and I smile and I laugh, but that thrill was legitimate. My first book was 2017, called A Celebration of Words. I wrote it as a textbook for my students because as a teacher, I found it was very frustrating. I could teach students how to read, but I couldn't teach them how to write. And so I started documenting and interviewing and archiving these interviews with people like Michael Conley, who writes Bosch and the Lincoln Lawyer, Jeanette Walls, who wrote The Glass Castle. So I created a situation where I let the authors talk about how they write, and I sit back and just let them talk about their craft. And I started doing that 20 years ago. And so that's really how I learned how to write, was by talking to a lot of writers.
Yeah, like inside the actor's studio.
Exactly.
Right, right,
I had two role models when I started. It was James Lipton and Terry Gross from NPR.
Excellent.
Oh, I like Terry Gross. I love her.
I was just going to say, yes. You just hit a soft spot for Sita.
Oh, I love her. Yeah.
But the hardest part was like when I was interviewing Michael Conley 20 years ago about The Lincoln Lawyer, was when he started talking about Mickey Haller, I had to put my tongue between my teeth and bite down and not talk over him because people didn't want to hear me. They wanted to hear Michael Conley.
Right.
So that was what I had to learn over time. Yeah.
So is that what you used for your internet show?
Yes.
Were these some of the interviews?
Yeah, these
that you
are
did?
All interviews. There's a couple hundred hours on the case. It's all free. You can get a master's in creative writing just by listening to the 10 interviews I did with Michael Conley. They're all free and archived. So
I can't wait, but Michael Conley is my boyfriend's number one writer. Like, loves. Like,
yeah,
all the Bosch series.
Michael came and taught my classes in 2009. He drove from Tampa to Orlando and taught all my classes one day because we've been friends for like 20 years. And he is as nice a guy as you would like to think he is. And he is... Michael was a superstar, but when television came along with Netflix, it exposed him to a worldwide audience. And now, when I talk to people, I refer to him as the guy who writes the Netflix series Bosch, because that's what made him a superstar, more so than, you know, the books that he wrote in the 90s. And he still writes today, but he is a fabulous writer.
He is.
And if you're like me, like, I remember when I was watching television back in the day, you're watching Starsky and Hutch,
mm-hmm.
or Frank Ken, or
mm-hmm.
whatever. You know, my favorite Farrah Fawcett, you know, Charlie's Angels, Indian Farrah Fawcett. I always had a knack for reading who the executive producer
mm-hmm.
was
mm-hmm.
and who the writer was. I don't know why, but I was drawn, like everybody would leave the room when the show ended. But I always was one of the credits.
Right.
And Michael Connelly, I remember seeing his name on television. Well, you're right. He had some television shows as well.
Yes.
He wrote, right?
Yes, he's very prolific.
Right, so you received an award in 2023, the Doug Marlett mm-hmm. Award for your book, Lifetime. It was the same one you just gave us here, Another Celebration of Words. So how did that feel and how did that come about?
Well, thank you, and it's nice to be interviewed by someone who's done some research. It's a rare rarity, so thank you. And yes, Doug Marlett was Pat Conroy's best friend, and they talked on the phone every day, and he died in 2007. Automobile accident. And so the Doug Marlett Award was set up to honor someone who has spent their lifetime promoting authors, books, and literacy. And so I was very honored to receive that because it was more about what I've done over the course of a lifetime to promote authors, books, and primarily literacy. It meant a lot to me, and it's kind of funny because I received this Lifetime Achievement Award really white when I'm just starting to publish my own books.
That's so cool.
So here's a question for you. Do you have any, you know, like how people start writing and they have like a half unpublished book, or they have a book that's left hanging and they're still waiting for the characters to come alive and for the plots to come together? Do you have any of those, or all of yours have been published?
I've got one that's going to come out in January called The Money Game. It's a murder mystery I wrote 25 years ago. And a friend of mine actually sent it to me last summer. She sent me a box of everything I'd written over the years that I'd given to her. And I didn't have a copy of this novel because there weren't thumb drives and that kind of thing. And so she sent it to me, and I read it. And I said, I really like this, so I'm in the process of rewriting that now, and that'll be out in January. But I've got a couple in the drawer. The question becomes, are they good enough to sell? Are they good enough to publish once you can publish? A lot of cases, the reason an author's second book isn't very good is because they put so much energy into the first one. And the second book is a book they wrote 10 years ago. And that's a mistake, to publish a book that's not better than the book you originally published. Because the second book comes out, it's not as good, and you lose all your momentum with bookstores and algorithms. And so I think every writer has stories, and I think it's a shame sometimes when writers die that their families go in and raid their raid the writing desk. If an author wanted something published, they would publish it in their lifetime.
Right.
So I discourage families from going to market with something that the parent didn't deem publishable. So in answer to your question, yes, I do have some stuff. And what I find is you have to update them to the technology of 2023. And in one case, it wasn't worth the battle for me because I don't understand technology well enough. But the one I'm working on now, it's kind of like historical fiction. It takes place in 1995 before cell phones and everything. And when I'm reading it, I don't have to say, I wonder if that's what it was like, because I wrote it 25 years ago. So it is what it was like. Yeah. So, yeah.
So what do you think literary success looks like for you?
I have no idea. I know that a good friend of mine, Andre Debuse, told me 30 years ago, don't worry about who will publish things or you lose hope to an abstraction. And I very much believe that if I worry about who's going to publish what I write, then I'm giving power to something which is an industry that's severely broken. And so I've, you know, the challenge of being an author is how to get your message out in 2023.
Yeah, we have so many mediums now, my gosh.
We do, but we're missing the core one, which is a good, strong bookstore.
Like sit down, curled up on the sofa with the fire going. Even in Florida, you could put on your fire and read a good book.
Yep.
I thought I was going to read more because I was such a traveler. So I had like all these books, all these management books in my head that I would listen to on my trips. But it was like, it was the turning pages that I missed. I mean, I missed the smell. You know, I can relate so much to the library story that you have, because I missed the smell. I missed the... So I canceled my Audible subscription because I was finding myself, I was like, no, I'm going to grab... And then more and more of my friends started writing books, which we've had on the show. And their stuff has been fantastic, and now I'm written into two books. Did you know that?
Yeah,
a character.
Yeah. Well, you know, everybody has a story to tell. I meet people. I mean, I could speak with that gray wall, and I'll get a story out of it. I meet people, and I've been a nurse for 33 years, and I've spoken with so many of the patients and their relatives and the staff and people I come in contact with, and everyone has a story, you know. But I just want to let our audience know who we're speaking with, right? We're speaking to Mr. Casey Coors. He's a retired high school English teacher. He taught critical reading and composition from 2007 to 2022. And he also hosts his own show, The Casey Coors Show. And he's also a published author of many books. And we are going to chat a little bit with him now about the book that you're going to be it's going to be published, and it's called Chasing the Queen's Gambit. Wow, I was reading about that book, and it's all about chess.
Yes.
And I read some really awesome things about the series. And Tina here said you kind of watched it a little bit on Netflix.
Oh, I watched the entire series start to finish on Netflix. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
So look, you've got people that actually know, and some of the takeaways from Chase of the Queen Gambit, take it from there. And why did you decide to write about the author who wrote that?
Well, I can't talk about Chasing the Queen's Gambit without talking about the grace of God in my life. That this was something, 40 years ago when I discovered Walter Tevis's work, I'd gone through a sea change in my life and got rid of some bad habits and pursuing new ones. And I became obsessed with Walter Tevis's work when I read it in 1984, 1985. And I set out on a biography, of writing a biography of him for 10 years. But nobody had ever heard of Walter Tevis, except that he wrote The Hustler and The Man Who Fell to Earth. But those were written, The Hustler was published in 1959. So younger people didn't know who Walter Tevis was. But I was standing in a Blockbuster one day, and there was The Color of Money, The Man Who Fell to Earth, and The Hustler were all available in video cassettes. This was like the 1990s.
Right.
I was like, how many authors that I've never heard of have three books that have been turned into movies? So, but I could never find a publisher who said, that's big enough. There's an audience for that. And I understood. So then, fast forward to 2020, when The Queen's Gambit came out on Netflix, and my life literally changed over. Because Walter Tevis has two children, Will and Julie, who I became friends with. And so when PBS called them, they said, there's only one person in the world that really knows our dad's story. His name's Casey Coars. We're not even sure where he lives, because I hadn't talked to them in 15 years. So that led to a PBS documentary, which is on their permanent collection, called Chasing Walter Tevis, Chasing the Gambit, or One Writer's Gambit. So I went to Lexington, Kentucky. I was on a PBS documentary, and that led into me rewriting, 25 years later, a book. And I went from Walter Tevis of life to Chasing the Queen's Gambit, because across the world, not just the United States, there's an obsession with chess right now. In China, it's huge. Young girls are playing chess.
There have been movies.
There have been movies.
Yeah, first woman that won a
chess
match.
That's nice. Yeah, and a Chinese gentleman just won the world championship last week. And so I caught a wave with the Queen's Gambit that I never in my wildest dreams could I imagine. And eventually I finished it a couple of weeks ago, and I finally said, you know what, Casey, nobody even knows what you're talking about. So any fact I was trying to split hairs with, I was like, nobody could prove whether it was right or wrong. You're the only person that knew his second wife. You know, so it's like, I finally just drew a line in the sand, and my wife helped me with that, just saying, Casey, you need to draw a line in the sand. You need to get this story out so that future scholars, when they want to study Walter Tevis, they have a resource material. And that's really what drove me to finish the book, was to being a teacher, to if my students later on want, or anybody wants to do research on Walter Tevis, there's not much of it that's out there right now.
They said he wrote a book about pool as well.
He wrote that's The Hustler cool. and The Color of Money.
Yeah.
Yeah, Paul Newman won the Academy Award for The Color of Money in 1987.
That's like one of my favorite movies.
Oh, it's fabulous.
Well, like he said, what's the odds that you walk into a Blockbuster, which, of course, we all went to Blockbuster way back then, and have three books that this guy wrote?
Well, believe me, it was the same thing when the Bosch series came out, and Brant, you know, my boyfriend Brant, he was like, oh my gosh, like Michael Connelly wrote these books. And I was like, who's Michael Connelly in the beginning?
Right.
And then he was like, oh my, So here, read this.
I guess in terms of literary success, I don't know what that looks like, but I do know I bet a couple horses that came in. You know, I invested a lot of time and money in Michael Connelly. I invested a lot of time and money in Walter Tevis, James Lee Burke, Jeanette Walls. So from a writer, from a reader's perspective, from a teaching perspective, I was, you know, I knew I was teaching good books. The fact that I got to know all of them well, I think that's what set me apart versus just interviewing them and writing a newspaper article. I wanted to go a little deeper with it. And so, much to my delight, I think, you know, I'm in a position where a lot more people are going to find out about Walter Tevis. Because his story is inspirational, besides being a great
He was born, he had a lot of illnesses to overcome. He faced a lot of challenges very early in his life.
He did. And so all of his books, he was hospitalized at the age of 10 with St. Vitus's dance and put in isolation for a year out in San Francisco. That's where The Man Who Fell to Earth came from, was his experience as a young child being hospitalized. The Hustler was the person that Walter would have liked to have been, the cocky pool player, but the fact of the matter was he had St. Vitus's dance and he wasn't a great pool player. He was a good chess player. But yeah, I think Tevis... part of success is serendipity, just in luck. So if The Queen's Gambit would not have come out in 2020, I wouldn't be sitting here. That's just the reality.
So do you see, while you're speaking, I'm thinking to myself, it seems to me as writing is very therapeutic for you, but it's also very spiritual based on everything you're saying.
Yes, it is. And I think that there was a great Delmore Schwartz short story called In Dreams Begin Responsibilities. And I think that when I realized that I was given a gift in terms of reading and writing, that there are responsibilities that go along with that. And this responsibility, I guess, to my creator, to write the best stories I can and try to explain the world I live in 2023. And that seems like a worthwhile thing for me to be doing right now, you know, sneaking up on the age of 66. So I hope to be able to, I love it when people are reading books, you know, and reading good books. And so the fact that everybody knows Michael Connelly and Bosch and stuff, that just makes me happy.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he's such a great guy, and he deserves it.
Yeah. You know? Oh, it's awesome. I can't wait to go home. I can't wait.
Well, it's interesting with the writer's strike now. They have Harry Bosch season 2's Lincoln Lawyer's in the can. So is the next season of Bosch Legacy. So they're waiting until the programming starts to dry up, and then they'll hit Bosch season two on preview.
I got the popcorn ready.
The
more you read about the writers' strike, the more you scratch your head like, really? That's all these writers make? Some of them don't have health insurance.
Right.
A lot of them live like two and three people to an apartment. It's rough stuff.
Writing's always been a tough thing, and that's one of the reasons why I taught for as long as I did. I was never willing to roll the dice and try to support myself.
Yeah. So let's
talk about. I think I was a good writer, but not good enough to make a living.
So let's talk about marketing.
So you don't have to. Yeah.
So what's writing a book is easy. Marketing the book is tough. So let's talk about the ways you're marketing the book, and give us your website and how someone can get a copy of one of your books.
Okay. Marketing is, I've had a social media presence for 20 years, and on Facebook it's just called A Celebration of Words. That's where I do reviews on Facebook, A Celebration of Words. I don't put my name on there because when I was teaching I didn't want people contacting me while I was teaching. So, but it is A Celebration of Words. And then on Amazon, the two textbooks I wrote and some other things are available on Amazon Prime. And Chasing the Queen's Gambit on July 1st will be available on Amazon Prime as an ebook, as a Kindle book, and then as a paper.
Fabulous.
Well, give us the website. Is there a website?
For me, it's just www.caseycoarshow.com.
Right. And how much research would you say you put into writing a book? You've followed most of the people you write about for a very long time.
I don't like to think about how much money I could have made if I made minimum wage while I was doing research for all the books I've written. I'd have a lot more money than I do now. Okay, but it's never been about money. I'm driven to write, and I'm obsessed with it. And it's like I'm at a point where if I'm obsessed about something, if it's something good for me, that's okay with me.
Yeah. I mean, everybody spends money, good and bad, right? What would you say you did with your first advance? What was the best thing you bought with your money?
I've never gotten a significant advance on anything. I've never really tried to make money from my writing before, because I was reviewing other people's books, and I felt there was an inherent conflict of interest if I turned that into a money-making thing where publishers offered me money to review a book. So I tried to keep my product pristine, not take money from organizations.
I think it's because you love what you do.
It is.
You
and
enjoy
I wanted,
it.
And my audience, if I ever reviewed a book that I didn't like, people would be able to tell in about 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Because I know whenever I listen to an interview or start reading a book, I'm like, this just isn't as good as what the author normally does. And so, but I think that I enjoy doing research. And that's one of the things that it's a lot easier for me to write fiction than it is nonfiction.
And would you say that writing a book and publishing a book has changed you in any way?
Yes, because in my life, there are times when I start a lot of projects and I don't finish them. So to actually start a book that I started writing 35 years ago and finish it is an incredible feeling. It's like completing a circle, but it doesn't have anything to do with money. Although I do hope to make money. I was a stockbroker for 25 years. I like money.
Yeah. Okay?
Right.
But it's like making money and selling my soul that's never been interesting.
And most important question before we go off air with this segment, your characters. Where do you get your characters from for some of the other books that you write?
My book called The Money Game, which is coming out in January, that's a Wall Street mystery. And everybody in that story were people I ran across during my 25 years working on Wall Street. So with each book in that series, I want to educate people about a particular part of investing. This first book is about real estate. Maybe the next one will be about how companies do IPOs. So John D. McDonald used to write stories, the Travis McGee series, that were kind of about business and the economy. And I find a lot of people are interested in the stock market and that kind of thing nowadays. So
yeah.
I'm taking that experience and putting it into my fiction. But I'm surprised that all this stuff is happening, and I'm very happy about it.
Yeah.
Well,
we might end up in one of his books.
That's right.
It could happen.
You never know. We've been in other people's books before.
That's so true. Unfortunately, we have to listen to our sponsors real quick and take a little station break. But thank you so much, Casey, for joining us for our first segment. And we'll be right back with Viewpoint with Sita and Friends right after these messages.
Cloud9 Mattress and Furniture is a family-owned furniture dealer featuring the best and most affordable brands. They offer all servicing for free. The delivery, setup, and home, removal of old furniture, and warranty. Work with a reputable and experienced local business as they strive for excellence with their customers. Scotty's been in the mattress and furniture business for 32 years. You can shop online, call, or stop into the showroom to place an order. They are conveniently located inside the Merritt Square Mall and service all of Brevard County and Central Florida. Super savings sale happening now. That's Cloud 9 Mattress and Furniture, 321-459-2473. Visit them on the web at Cloud 9. That's Cloud number 9. Furniture.com. Again, 321-459-2473 for Cloud 9.
Welcome Mattress to MedFast and Furniture. We are Brevard County's largest urgent care network. MedFast is now open at 7:30 a.m. every day. That's right, 7:30 a.m. every day. We will get you in and out so you can get back to your day. When you are sick or injured, MedFast is here for you 7 days a week. Think fast. Think MedFast. With 18 locations, there's a MedFast near you.
Are you longing for a taste of Louisiana? Lizette's Cajun Bistro is the place to be. They offer Cajun and Creole staples as well as American, vegan, and vegetarian options. The restaurant is located at 2447 North Wickham Road, Unit 146. All menu items are prepared daily from scratch and made to order. Dine in or take out as well as outside seating. Live music on selected weekends. So the next time you have a taste for Louisiana, stop by Lizette's Cajun Bistro, 2447 North Wickham Road.
Located in Titusville, Florida, Dixie Crossroads has been serving great tasting seafood, char-grilled steaks, prime rib, chicken, fresh salads, and their famous corn fritters for over 31 years. The menu features the very best local shrimp and fish from Port Canaveral and ranges from low-cost sandwiches and baskets to high-end seafood combos. Visit this Florida favorite at 1475 Garden Street in Titusville. That's Dixie Crossroads, 321-268-5000. 321-268-5000 or visit them on the web at DixieCrossroads.com.
is a certified public accounting and a registered investment advisory firm with over 30 years of productive relationships with clients. Choctaw Financial Group can assist you in meeting your accounting, tax, and business consulting and financial planning and insurance needs without expanding your internal workforce. With three locations here in Florida, here in Brevard County, Broward County, and Nassau County, contact Jotkoff Financial Group here in Brevard at 321-984-7345. Located at 1122 South Wickham Road in Melbourne, that's Jotkoff Financial Group. On the web, you'll find them at www.jotkoff, that's JOTKOFF.com. Call the professionals.
There's something special about the place we call home. It's the place we live our lives, spend time with family and friends, and make our own. At St. Francis Reflections Hospice, we consider it a privilege to care for you wherever your home may be. We put our hands, hearts, and skills into providing high-quality hospice care in your home. To learn more about how we reflect life, love, and compassion, visit www.reflectionslsc.org.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Sita Begee on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends right here in sunny Cocoa, Florida. We're heard on AM 1510. Our dial is WWBC, FM 94.7, 99.9, 100.7, and online everywhere.
All over the World Wide Web, 1510 WWBC. You can hit that Listen Live button, or you can hit any one of the archive shows by date and search by name if you'd like. Certainly on our Facebook pages and on SetaMediaInc.com.
Right. And we, our first segment was awesome. Thank you so much, Mr. Casey Kors. It's awesome to have great people on our show that we learn something from.
Every single week we do.
Right.
Every single week.
And I just wanted to give a shout out to my nephew, Sanjay Ram Logan, who is here with us in studio with Ellen O'Neill and Ali Tambor. Casey Gores is here, and Sanjay is here. Welcome to our show, Sanjay.
Thank you.
Yeah, Sanjay is on, he's taking a break from studying, so his auntie's cooking some food and taking care of him and his cousins.
He's taking a break from studying, but he's over here devouring Casey's book while we're sitting here. So Casey and Tina have already been through it.
Our second segment is with Tina Deskovich, and as you all know, Tina's been, you know, I was looking at the news, and I'm watching Tina on CNN, and I'm thinking, she lives right here in Satellite Beach. Why don't I get her on my show, on our show, here on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends? So Ellen and I devised a plan, and we always go through the guests, and Ellen said, sure, let's do it, and here we are. Mm-hmm. Danny said yes, and Ali said yes, and we said we have Tina on our show.
That's right.
Why should she be on Fox and MSNBC and CNN and not on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends? That don't make no sense.
We probably have more coverage here, right here in Brevard County.
And so Tina has a long record of fighting for students and parental rights here in Florida. She was elected to the Brevard County School Board in 2016. She was selected by her peers in 2017 to serve as the vice chairman and chairman in 2018. And so many other things. And so we're gonna let Tina speak for herself. Tina, welcome to our show. Thank you for taking the time to drive all the way to Cocoa.
I had to get on 95.
Yeah.
I'm just happy to hear that everyone in this room voted and they all agreed I should come on, because you didn't say like that he or she voted no.
No.
I'm absolutely.
Well, you know, we go through our list and we're like, we have people who are calling in or people who want to talk about a business or a product or a service. And then we've got, who's coming on our show? And I said, I wanted you to come on, and was unanimous yes, right?
Yes, absolutely.
So let's talk a little bit. You're beautiful, by the way. And I can't believe you're a grandmother and five children.
I'm a Gigi. We don't say grandmother. We say Gigi.
Exactly. I'm a nanny.
I'm a Gigi.
I'm a nanny.
It's a good name.
I'm a nanny. It's amazing nowadays how people change up the names, right? I'm just Nanny Sita. I have adopted grandchildren all over the place now, too. So you've been in the news a lot. We've got Moms for Liberty, and it's nationwide, and you've got over 200 chapters.
Almost 300. We're approaching 300.
I had read it was 238 at one time. Now it's approaching. And you guys, you're changing the face of who is elected into office from the local level all the way to the state and national.
We focus really on school boards. So our chapters can endorse. We're approaching 280, 285 chapters right now. They can only endorse in school board races. And so we at the national help promote them, what the local chapters decide, but we aren't endorsing in any other level of elected officials.
Okay.
And we need that, because we were just talking about that on the little bit of a break. Who knows who your school board officials are, and who do you know, right? Who do you know on the school board? If you asked anybody on the street, I'm sure most couldn't.
3 years ago, nobody could tell you. And that was the problem. You know, I ran 2016 and in 2020, knocked over 8,000 doors in 2016. Go back around and knock doors again. People don't remember.
People don't even remember I ran in 2009 for the school board.
I knew that. I knew that because I went back and did research, of who ran and who won and, all the things
so,
that you do.
So for listeners who tune in, and Tina was chatting with my nephew, Sanjay, and myself before the show. And she was amazed about the literacy rate in Trinidad and Tobago. So, Sanjay, we just want you to just reiterate again. What was the literacy rate in Trinidad that Tina was so stunned about? The literacy rate?
I think it was 98.7%.
Wow. I hope your listeners hear that. Most of them probably don't know what the literacy rate is in the United States for public school children in America. But I'm going to tell them right now. It's about 30%. About a third of American students in fourth grade and then again in eighth grade can read on grade level. So explain to me how Trinidad has a 98%?
97. We Googled it just to be on the safe side. So we know
we know it's close, right? We can't say it's gospel, but it's certainly close. And of course, Trinidad's the size of what?
1.2 million people.
Rhode Island?
Yeah.
You know, about that. But still, 97%. That says a lot.
Right. Well, it's about the parents. Parents getting involved. So here's the thing. I speak with people from all walks of life, people from India, the Middle East, right here in the United States, the Caribbean, people I work with, people at the gym. I'm a talker. I talk to people, but I'm nice about it. I'm kind about it. I'm mindful about it.
Did you pick up on that Trinidadian New York talking?
I'm not going to be rude to people because I want to learn from them. So here's the thing. What started the Moms for Liberty chapter in Brevard County, Florida? Why? why did you guys have to start that? Something must have happened and you said, this is it. An aha moment, right?
Something happened. For sure. So, you know, I ran in 2016, like I said, here in Brevard, and one of the four pillars I ran on was parental rights even then. I had no idea where that was going to go at that point, but it was a concern of mine then that parents were making the decisions for children and their education over, say, the school districts or even the state for that matter. At that point, the state was getting involved a ton in testing and putting excessive testing on teachers and students, and so I had real concerns about that. But as 2020 unfolded and things with COVID happened, I sat there on the school board and watched individual parents come in very concerned about things like masking. A mom who was deaf who had a deaf child came in. She had tears in her eyes. She said, I don't understand how my daughter's going to communicate in the classroom. I don't understand how she's going to hear and learn. And I worked, you know, for the school district. I worked for the people, but, you know, I served in Brevard Public Schools, who historically had cared deeply. I had watched pretty much all 9,000 employees care deeply about every single student, every single parent. And what I saw happen during COVID when fear took over is I saw them just ignore, like, we're not even going to give an exception to that mom and that student. We're not even going to give an exemption here or there. And so it really became concerning to me. At the same time, my co-founder of Moms for Liberty, Tiffany Justice from Indian River.
Who I met when I came to that event with you guys.
Yes. Yeah. Whoa. Yeah. You're going to tell everybody you were there. You're going to get yourself in trouble.
I was at the Mom Megyn Kelly event, right?
Yes. It was our very first event.
Yes.
You know, we started realizing we were seeing the same things in our districts, and we became very concerned. And then, I mean, everybody, look around what you saw in 2020. A lot of it wasn't happening here in Brevard, but it was happening nationally. School board meetings were getting shut down. Parents were being locked out. Their time was being reduced from 3 to 1 minute. Like, parents' voices were being shut down, and it was getting extreme and serious, and parents didn't know how to advocate. Like, even here in Brevard, I remember one mom just so upset, and she was like, she yelled at us. This is when I was still on the board. I'm going to call the county commissioners on you. And I thought, county commissioners don't have a drip of authority over the school board. There's nothing they can do.
Yeah.
And what it showed
it's
me,
a
though,
separate entity by itself.
Completely separate entity.
But here's the thing. Like, when the school board members, right, makes decisions for all the schools. During COVID, of course, you know, I'm a nurse. Right?
Yes.
I wore my mask. I'll never forget her wearing, you know, like a curtain. And we understood what was going on. Do you feel like maybe they should have sat with that family and talked to them instead of shutting them down and not giving them a hearing?
Provided either an exemption or an alternative or some other tools. And it wasn't just the one deaf family. There were other circumstances. When, you know, my closing speech at my last school board meeting, I held up, I don't know, 5 or 6 pictures of a child that had MRSA all in their face. And the doctor wanted them not to have a mask on, I think, for a week for it to heal. No exceptions. Like, no matter what we discuss, like, we need to treat each student individually. That's what we've done historically in Brevard. One student who's tested negative for COVID coming into school for a week while their face heals is not going to shut down Brevard Public Schools. But there was no rational thinking. And so it's very disturbing to me and a lot of other parents.
I just want you to finish that one thought, that one parent that came to you and saying, I'm going to call the city commissioners on you. Just the awareness that you don't know, like, the parents didn't know what resource and what was their next realm of what they were supposed to do. You know, what do you do? Call the police? You know, who do you call? You call the president?
They truly don't know.
You don't know what it is in the school board of how to defend your children.
So the idea of Moms for Liberty in the beginning, absolutely, was just to, like, just for us to share our knowledge of serving on the school boards, how government works. We were just going to be in Florida.
Yeah, because both of you were ex-school board members.
She was serving in Indian River.
Did you know when you started the chapter here in Brevard that it was going to grow so rapidly? Because it's almost like there were parents out there who were thirsting for this. People has gotten to a point where they want to get involved in their children's lives at school. But did you know it was going to grow this rapidly?
Tiffany always says she knew. Every time we get asked that question, she's like, I knew it, absolutely. But I absolutely did not know. My plan, I drew up our plan for our organization, was to be in 67 counties in the state of Florida. I wanted to grow statewide over 5 years. That's where I thought we were going. We launched January 1st of 2021. Within 2 weeks, a mom called from Long Island, New York, and said, I have to start a chapter. And I said, I don't know anything about education in New York. It's structured very different. The powers and authorities are very different. I don't know that I can help you. She said, we can figure it out, but I need something to organize parents under. And so we approved her chapter, and then, you know, here we are 2.5 years later.
I think the United States, all 50 states and Democrats, Independents, Republicans, everyone started paying attention to Moms for Liberty when Glenn Youerkin got elected, because he ran on a ticket of parents taking responsibility for their children in school. Am I correct? Because I think that's what opened my eyes. I'm like, wait a minute.
Nationally.
Yeah, because he...
I love what you just said, though, Sita. You said responsibility. And right. A lot of people forget that, and I do try to emphasize that, but it's getting lost. This isn't just about parental rights movement. Parents need to take responsibility. There's the reason school districts, I think, have stepped in and they're making so many decisions on behalf of children and have over time is because parents have neglected a lot of their responsibilities, and I saw it firsthand when I served on the school board.
Yeah. I'm forgetting who Mr. Youerkin ran against, but I do know it was a top Democrat, and we were all concerned about that. So how do we get people to communicate, have a conversation, and collaborate with each other instead of all this screaming and yelling? Because at the end of the day, it is about the children. It's about all the children, right? And it's about how do we get each child in the public school system to have a quality education. How do we get people to get back to the table and stop the noise? Like, we should care. All of us should care. They're all our children. But how do we start that conversation?
It's a really great question, and it's an important question. I think there's some things working against us these days, and one of it is social media. I mean, you're on social media. You see it.
Yeah.
People are faceless, and they can, you know, throw accusations at each other that they would never do in person. And so I think one of our main tenets in the organization is to build relationships. And I know we get a lot of negative media and a lot of criticisms that are out there publicly, but our chapter chairs around the country really are working hard at behind the scenes building relationships with Democrats, Republicans, independents, you name it, their school board members, their leaders at the school. And in most districts, they're doing a beautiful job. And you sit down at the table and you have these discussions. I think it's vital. You have to meet face-to-face. You have to look at people like they're human beings. Understand where you have common ground. You both have children you're very concerned about, and move forward in the conversations from there.
Right. And the problem is, too, I think, is that all of this is unprecedented, right? What we went through in the last 3 years is nobody, there was no roadmap for any of this, right? So we had so many different shells, if you will. And then you take the other side of it, and most people were kind of trapped at home too. So the only thing they got was this news media, social media craze, right? So there was no divergent thinking of being able to look outside the box a little bit and say, okay, look, you've never been through this. I've never been through this. How we get through it together is we're going to disagree on some things. We're going to maybe not necessarily, we see eye to eye. But bottom line is that we have to remember that the family structure is what we're trying to fight for here. You know, the ability for moms and for teachers and for principals. You know, I remember a comic strip really quick. Remember a comic strip saying, like, seeing in the 1970s, moms and teachers were on one side of the desk and the child was on the other side of the desk, right?
Yeah.
And now, in the comic actually showed in the 2020 system, it's the moms and the dads and the kid is against the teacher and against everybody else. And I'm like, we're never going to get to a point of being able to see eye to eye, or at least appreciate other
people. Well, we can if we can have a conversation.
Exactly.
We can. So, exactly. So Tina, what do you say to people like with the National Education Association that calls Moms for Liberty dangerous? And you know they have.
Yeah, I try not to talk bad about people. I know that I get called a lot of names and that I say hateful things, but you can't find one hateful thing I've ever said about anybody because I just don't do it. But I will say something negative about the National Teachers Union. I don't think they're good people. I don't think they're in it for the kids. Local teachers union, different. A lot of them are teachers here locally. They have kids in the school. Very different. But, you know, I've had some problems with them in the past, too. But the NEA, for example, they have hundreds of millions of dollars. And when you look at their agenda in the summer from their conference that they put together and what things they were discussing and voting on, they were voting on foreign policy, abortion rights, things that have nothing to do. When you have
like
only
achieving a 98.7 illiteracy
yes!
rate.
Like everything should point to kids learning in America. Like until we, 30% of American students in fourth and eighth grade are reading on grade level. 30%. The National Education Association
needs to go there. So you bring back a great point. Like my mom used to say, you're going to school for reading, writing, and arithmetic. And sometimes she'll add in penmanship. which you would love.
Right? Well, he didn't care how neat it
so,
was.
So
I'm
we
sure.
have, and as you know, the whole world knows, I'm a moderate Democrat. I'm not crazy left, crazy right. I'm not neither. But I do listen to people, right? And I hear folks who have children who are trans or they're gay or they're different, and they're all concerned. My kid won't get a quality education. But you're not saying that. Your vision is not for them not to get an education.
Of course not.
What is the mission of Moms for Liberty? So those who are listening can calm their fears and know that it is about the children. It is about all children. And maybe what they ought to do is do what I do and have a conversation with you and say, what is your mission?
Our mission is to empower parents, to unify, educate, and empower parents to defend their parental rights. It's very simple. And we stay focused on that. We work with all of our chapters. We actually have a flow chart. They need to stay focused on that. Our overarching biggest concern is that parents are losing the authority to raise their children. Once government entities, whether it be federal, state, and even local government entities, start making policies at the district level, per se, that work against what the parents are teaching at home, that work against against the family and what's going on, we're really going to be in real trouble in America. And
yeah, so, it's like, you're right, what's on social media, if you really follow what's people are saying about Moms for Liberty, I saw something this morning where somebody says, I don't co-parent with Moms for Liberty. Dude, who are you co-parenting with? You're supposed to be co-parenting with the person that brought your child into this world
I
with you.
I don't want to parent your children. Yeah. I promise you. I've got enough of my own.
Oh, they'll say, I don't co-parent with DeSantis. But here's the thing. If you have children and you don't have a father figure in their lives and you're accepting money from the state for, you know, food and rent and public school.
You are
school.
Co-parenting.
Somebody's co-parenting with you, us, the taxpayers.
Ding, ding, ding.
All right, Ali, take it from there. Ali, jump in. I mean, I'm not saying that it's right or wrong. I'm just saying that
it's just facts.
If someone has to help, right?
It is. It's just, it is facts. I know I'm an old lady. I turned 70 this year. So just for those of you out there that might not, you know this, this gorgeous, sexy
but was a single mom of
yes,
two boys.
But I was a single mom of two sons, and it takes a village. That's the words, you know. They've been out there forever. I remember going to see my dad dragged me in to see the math teacher, and I'm standing there just mortified because my father is reaming this one out and saying, you know, what do you think you're doing, this base five business? I can't make change while using base five. This is what my daughter needs to learn, you know. And, but I mean, they jumped on it, got to the school before the teachers got out and had an opportunity to voice. But it shows commitment to being part of the issues and the things you need to do to become a teacher as well. Everybody's, you know, the parents have to be teaching. Let me take a look at that theme you wrote for class tomorrow. I'll handle the math stuff. Let me see. What are you doing in trigonometry right now? Those kinds of things, and that was the conversation around the dinner table. And so I think a lot of this falls way back on how we have a family network, and can we get back to having a cohesive family network.
25 years ago, I was picking my nephew up pretty regularly from school, and when they put signs up that told parents that they were not allowed to have their cell phone on in the loop, in the car pickup loop, I knew it had nothing to do with traffic. It was about the fact that I watched other parents. Now, I was an aunt, so it wasn't, you know, I wasn't necessarily,
well,
like, responsible.
I got your girl.
But nonetheless, they would get in the car, and my, you know, my nieces and nephews and their friends or whatever, you know, we'd have a conversation. The rest of the time, I would watch moms, and I'm not faulting anybody, but it's like, you can't take 10 minutes right, to see how your kid did in school today, and it can't be the first thing that they
see. I think
see,
the majority of people do. The majority of people.
Yeah,
because
there's a sign up now.
Well, you know, I remember once, when you pick your kid up from school, people normally say, how was your day? But here's the thing. The word freedom. Everybody uses the word freedom, right? I know I used to use the word freedom to my mother all the time. I want freedom. And the definition of freedom is the power to right, the power or right to act, speak, or think as one wants, right? But here's the thing. In our public school system, we want children to be free of expression. We want them to have freedom of speech. But But also, we want age-appropriate materials for children. And that seems to be one of the tenets of what you guys are talking about. And a lot of people have taken that, what you say about the age appropriateness and the type of books, the grade level of the books, and they've run away with it in all different directions. How do we bring those people back and say, wait a minute?
Make the messaging better.
Let's just stop you right there, because there's something that's going on here and you ought to listen.
If you can figure that out, please let me know. Because exactly what's going on, like you said, is age appropriateness. We put out all kinds of information, press releases. The thing is, media wants clickbait. They want headlines. And so they label us as book banners and people want to click on it immediately. Look, you know, nobody wants their kids exposed to some of this stuff. I think you've probably seen it. That's why we're having this discussion. And whether they do or not, every parent deserves a conversation at the table about that. That's what our education system, that's how it's developed. Other countries have top-down education systems. In America, it's meant for parents to go to your local school board in your community and have these discussions. In our community, this book is very appropriate. In another community, it may not be appropriate. And so, you know, the point is it should be open to these discussions. And you quoted what the word freedom is. And yes, that is the definition of freedom. We are not Moms for Freedom. We picked our name very
but you know how a lot of people associate the word liberty with freedom,
correct?
Right? Yes.
But liberty means something very different.
Yes.
Liberty is more you do what you have the freedom to do what you ought to do.
Right.
Not just the freedom to cause chaos and do whatever the heck you want. You should do what you ought to do.
So
and we ought
to
protect
children.
Where
are we at with these books? Because we talked earlier about there's going to be a review before the books come back on the shelf or before you can get it in a public library.
Yeah, so in Brevard County, even when I served on the school board, there was a book review committee that worked Satellite High when I was on the board years ago. A gentleman came forward, had concerns. It was an AP book, but it was in a library where there was junior high school and high school kids. We put it in a section that was just available to AP students. I mean, there's so many solutions here. If everyone would stop yelling and name-calling and sit down and have a discussion about what's best for children at what age.
Well, I'm not going to lie. I did see a couple of the books, and I ran it by a few of my friends, and people are like, no, this book doesn't belong in the school. But if they want to read it in a public library, if they want to buy it, they can.
Buy the book, sell the book, write the book, put the book in the public library.
Put it under your pillow.
Put it under your pillow. Give it to your own kids in your own home. But if it's a really questionable book with obscene materials, it shouldn't be in the public school library. There's no room on the shelf for that. There's so many rich, wonderful books that need to be read. Our children need to learn to read.
So most important, folks, vote. People are talking about the books without even opening the book to read it. A lot of parents are coming to the school board and making trouble, and they don't even read themselves. How do you get your kid to read? You got to read yourself, right?
And one other piece, too, is if I could just interject this one part. Go in curiosity and not in judgment. If we can start learning that as human beings, of going and asking questions, why are you banning that book? Or why don't you think that book is appropriate? Instead of judging and yelling and screaming and going with that force and jumping to conclusions. Absolutely.
Well, I think because of all the noise, people are not getting the right message in, mm-hmm. but they ought to start listening to each other. And right here in Brevard, we all need to stop it and start listening and having a conversation and communicating with each other, because it's all about the children. It's not about us.
Tina right? Deskovich, we are out of time, but floridamomsforliberty.org, is that the correct website?
Mm-hmm.
That's how we get in touch with you?
Absolutely.
I can't wait. I hope everybody here who's listening on our Viewpoint with Sita and Friends show this week, you have an opportunity to kind of calm yourselves down. And if there's any questions about this types of things, reach out to Tina Deskovich. Certainly reach out to us here at Viewpoint with Sita and Friends, and we can get you in touch with them. Casey Cowers, thank you so much for being with us today. And another fantastic episode of Viewpoint with Sita and Friends. We'll see you next week.